This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and it's a pleasure to have you with us again for our broadcast and online Main Street across North Dakota. Today we'll begin our show talking about the biggest issue, the biggest story of the century at this point, and that is, of course, the pandemic and how it affects people in all walks of life, including, most importantly, the medical profession. Dr. Kinsey Nelson is the head of the medical department at Family Healthcare in Fargo. He joins us to talk about this and other things. Thanks for being with us, Dr. Nelson.
Thanks for having me.
What is the mission of the Family Healthcare Facility for the Fargo-Moorhead area?
Our overarching mission at Family Healthcare is to provide high-quality healthcare to all people. We strive to provide high quality care to all individuals, regardless of their ability to pay for services. We serve all patients, whether they have insurance or if they're uninsured or underinsured. And that's been the mission of Family Healthcare for many years, continues to be the mission throughout the COVID-19 pandemic.
So you are a safety net, among other things.
Yeah, as it pertains to people without insurance, we absolutely are a safety net. We also serve all patients with insurance, and you know, we are certainly a vital primary care clinic for really all individuals as well.
You are certified by the American Board of Family Medicine. How would you define your area of specialization, family medicine?
So family medicine obviously is a very wide-ranging specialty. Really, if you had to boil it down, the specialty is primary care and preventive care. As part of that, we have a focus on, you know, screening tests, screening labs, preventive care measures to be proactive about identifying disease before it becomes a problem. But we also, you know, we serve all ages from newborns to the elderly and everybody in between. A lot of what we do is also focused on chronic disease management. You know, obviously, there's a lot of high blood pressure, diabetes, high cholesterol, asthma, COPD, you know, really, we're kind of a one-stop shop for, you know, pretty much anybody that has a medical concern. We're certainly able to manage a lot of things exclusively ourselves, but when there's something that is beyond our level of training within family medicine, then we also serve largely as kind of a coordinator of care when we're referring patients to other specialties.
How has the pandemic affected normal operations at Family Healthcare?
So not surprisingly, it's had a pretty profound impact on, quote, business as usual. Quite early on, as things really ramped up in mid to late March, we made a pretty rapid transition to doing all of our medical visits over telehealth. Initially, when we didn't exactly know how things were going to play out on the front end of the pandemic, that included having most of our providers working remotely from home to try to keep them and the rest of our staff as safe as possible. Over the course of the spring and the summer, as we got a little bit more of a handle on exactly kind of the direction things were moving, we did transition back into providing care directly in clinic, which is something we continue to this day. We did make fairly extensive changes within the clinic itself, including screening all individuals that come through our front doors for any symptoms concerning for COVID. We have a designated isolation area where we can serve those patients, you know, without potentially exposing others in the building. Pretty much from the start of COVID, we've required all individuals in our building to wear masks to further help reduce the spread of COVID. And even now that we are providing on-site direct patient care, we still incorporate telehealth into essentially a hybrid model, where a lot of our visits will start out with the patient in an exam room and the provider in their own office, having the bulk of the discussion, you know, over the computer with video conference. Then in appropriate circumstances, when the provider needs to go into the room to perform a physical exam or, you know, to have an additional discussion or whatever the case may be, we then go into the room with full personal protective equipment on. And really, the goal of this is to really try to minimize the amount of time that a provider is in direct contact with a patient. As we've learned more about COVID-19, we know that it's kind of a cumulative exposure that is a more significant risk factor for acquiring the infection itself. So that, among quite a few other things around the clinic, has certainly affected our day-to-day operations. And it's a point of pride around here. To the best of our knowledge, to date, we have not had any staff that have actually acquired COVID-19 from being at work or from interacting with a patient.
Well, that hasn't been the case at other healthcare providers, so keep your fingers crossed.
I'm knocking on something in here.
Have you treated COVID patients?
Oh, absolutely. We have also had, pretty much from the start of COVID, have had a state-sponsored testing event right outside of our downtown clinic, currently testing upwards of 230 people per day. And a lot of those results kind of find their way through my inbox and signing off on those results. I mean, there's a pretty striking positivity rate within our patient population. You know, we have patients who come in with a known diagnosis of COVID who, you know, maybe they're not feeling well or they have additional concerns they want to talk about. So we obviously with that, we place them in our isolation area to reduce the risk to others. But not infrequently, we'll see a patient for a routine visit or some other specific concern they may have and encourage them to be tested on their way out. And then within a few days, you get that result back indicating that they are positive. So kind of the message I've really been trying to instill in people is to always have the assumption that not only could the patient potentially have COVID, but always assume that you could potentially have it as well. Obviously, we know there's a lot of people that may be asymptomatic despite having the infection and still places them at risk for infecting others. So we've really tried to be vigilant with, again, being sure everybody's wearing masks at all times and taking other safety precautions.
You mentioned the couple hundred of tests that you perform at your facility in downtown Fargo every day. The number of positive tests statewide have gone just shot up in the past couple of weeks. Are we likely to see that rate go down or plateau and rise again? What do the projections indicate? What does your own experience indicate?
I wish I had a better sense of exactly what direction it would go. My concern is obviously the trajectory that it has been on, especially entering into the holidays. I think it really boils down to how much personal responsibility individuals take to protect themselves and protect others. In the last several weeks here, we've kind of entered that exponential part of the curve as far as fairly unmitigated community spread. And my personal feeling is that without more aggressive measures as far as universal mask wearing, social distancing, trying to limit large gatherings of people, whether that's in their personal lives or, you know, at bars and restaurants, other things like that, you know, I think the data is pretty clear that until some of those more aggressive measures are in place, there's going to be ongoing significant community spread. Obviously, there's been a lot in the news recently about some very promising data as it pertains to vaccines that are on their way. And so what I've really been trying to, encourage my patients as well as our staff here is that there is a light at the end of the tunnel. This has been a very challenging 8 months up to this point, and it's obviously going to be very challenging through the winter as well. But knowing that there is a finish line, maybe we don't know exactly where that is, but this isn't something that's going to be forever. And it's very challenging, especially with the holidays. I've had a lot of patients ask me, well, what's your opinion? Is it okay if I travel? Is it okay if I have family come over? And unfortunately, even with having people test on a regular basis, there are still windows where you could miss, you know, somebody who maybe tested negative at noon today, but by midnight they would have turned positive, and they then have kind of a false sense of security as it pertains to getting together with other people. So it's a very hard discussion to have for a lot of people. Obviously, the holidays and family mean a lot, but I've really tried to encourage people to say, you know, maybe missing Thanksgiving this year means everybody will be there for Thanksgiving next year, and it's just one of the many sacrifices that COVID requires of us.
Medical professionals like you have had to face this kind of disconnect between the vast group of people out there who are Googling and sharing on social media different opinions about how we should protect ourselves or not protect ourselves, maybe just to go for herd immunity. The state of North Dakota and the city of Fargo have imposed mandates with enforcement. Would you have preferred those mandates sooner?
Yes, I absolutely would have. The data, which is out there, and I mean, the thing about data is objective data does not have an opinion. It is what it is. And as a medical provider, you are trained to use evidence to base your decisions. There's obviously a lot of other layers of complexity that factors into this, especially with schools and with businesses and everything else. But yes, personally, I would have preferred to have seen a statewide mask mandate or other more aggressive measures be in place sooner. It's my feeling that that could have helped curb the spread of this earlier on. Where we're at now, you know, what's done is done, but I would certainly encourage everybody to really take this as seriously as you can. And honestly, you know, wearing a mask, it's annoying. I mean, I in clinic, I'm wearing an N95 for hours of the day. It's not comfortable. But if that means keeping my family safe, keeping my daughter safe, I mean, that's a very small price to pay. So I really, really just ask that people put up with the minor inconvenience of things like that for just a few more months, just so we avoid more death and suffering in the state.
Dr. Kinsey Nelson is the head of the medical department at Family Healthcare in Fargo. And as a member of the medical community in Fargo-Moorhead, are you in communication with your colleagues at Sanford or Ascensia? What do you know about the capacity of our hospitals to deal with growing numbers of patients? Have you been involved in planning for handling patients if we exceed capacity, for example?
Yeah, I certainly have friends and colleagues that work at various health systems within our community. And I know we're kind of heading down a concerning path as it pertains to the potential of, you know, not having adequate hospital beds or adequate staffing for hospital beds. And I think an important thing for people to realize is that doesn't mean just people needing to be hospitalized for COVID. That means an otherwise healthy person that has an acute appendicitis. That means people involved in a car accident or a heart attack or other things like that. So again, that's where really trying to flatten the curve as it stands right now is very important. Though I personally haven't had direct discussions with leadership within the other facilities in town, internally that very much is a focus for us at Family Healthcare is what can we do to lessen the burden on the hospitals, on the emergency room and patients requiring admission. And that's why we're trying to do everything we can to keep our staff as healthy as possible, to keep them here at work so that, you know, if you're a patient who has type 2 diabetes and you're getting a little bit past due for your regular checkup, or you've had some kind of nagging, lingering symptoms that you haven't necessarily wanted to go into the emergency room for or be seen for, that is absolutely the role that we want to serve as a primary care clinic. You know, we would much rather address these issues earlier on before they get to a crisis point where you have to be hospitalized or you have to go to the emergency room. I mean, we do have the capacity to be seeing patients with disease processes that are not yet to the point of requiring hospitalization. And it's kind of a mainstay of primary care is the focus on what can you do now to intervene so that something doesn't become, you know, a crisis later this week or a year from now or 10 years from now.
And the pandemic might be exacerbating other issues, healthcare issues like mental and emotional health. We've got a lot of people who are older and perhaps isolated. How does that clientele get served under these circumstances?
Yeah, that's an excellent point, and it's a very challenging situation. I mean, within the scope of primary care certainly includes behavioral health, whether that's major depressive disorder or generalized anxiety or situational anxiety, you know, especially as it pertains to COVID. We have a behavioral health department here at Family Healthcare, which includes psychiatric services as well as counseling. And that's also another avenue where we still have the option of, patients connecting with those services over telehealth, if that's their preference to do these visits from the safety of their home. I mean, we're really trying everything we can to increase the capacity to address those concerns as well, because obviously that's as much a medical emergency for some people as having a heart attack. If you're really struggling with depression and with everything going on related to COVID, that can be a very serious issue. And so, we're certainly here trying to help the community with that. I know a lot of the other healthcare facilities in the area are doing likewise. But that is kind of a hidden toll that the COVID-19 pandemic has taken, as you alluded to, especially in our senior population. A lot of long-term care facilities and skilled nursing facilities and assisted living have more or less been on lockdown, and that can be a a very isolating issue for patients. And you frequently hear that so-and-so has noticed, yeah, dad has really gone downhill these last few months without being able to interact. And so I think this all really feeds back to the more that the rest of us who are not in that situation can do everything we can to slow the spread of this, to allow us to relax those restrictions sooner for our senior population.
Well, let's go to the other end of the age spectrum here. We've got universities basically recommending that their students not go home for Thanksgiving for reasons of, you know, limiting transmission. What do you say to people who contend that COVID-19 is not necessarily a serious medical issue for young people? You know, they can shrug it off, it doesn't affect them, that kind of thing.
My quick take on that is that it's disappointing to hear that kind of mindset. You know, having been young myself at one point, I understand kind of that feeling of invincibility. And well, if this isn't going to hurt me, then what do I care about it? You know, I often think about the quote from Dr. Fauci saying, I don't know how to convince you that you should care for other people. And so this is really one of those situations where it's not always just about you. This is very much something that could affect, you know, their extended family, their parents, their grandparents. But at the same time, you know, you do hear the occasional report that there's no guarantee that if an otherwise healthy 20-year-old individual catches this, that they're going to be perfectly okay. You know, tragically, there are reports, and we've even seen it in our state, of people in their 20s who have passed away from COVID. I also feel that a lot of focus gets paid to the deaths from COVID, as it should. I mean, obviously, that's an absolutely devastating outcome from this. But I feel there's not been as much attention paid to the long-term sequelae or the long-term effects of COVID in individuals who do survive it. And this is something, you know, I think in the years to come, we're definitely going to see that portion of the population emerge, kind of this, you know, so-called long-haul COVID carriers who can have really debilitating long-term symptoms. You know, they survive the infection, but, you know, perhaps they never really return to their previous baseline, and that can include young people. I mean, you've got your whole life ahead of you. What we're asking you to do at this point, as frustrating and annoying as it is, again, isn't something that's going to last forever. And so I would really, really encourage that population just to look at the big picture, you know, try to think of others in addition to yourself and the impact that it could have on them.
Dr. Kenzie Nelson is the head of medical department at Family Healthcare in Fargo. Dr. Nelson, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you much.
Tomorrow on Main Street, we'll talk with Dr. Matt Eaton. He's the director of dental services at Family Healthcare. We hope you can join us for that discussion as well. Coming up on Main Street, Tom Ezern.
President-elect Joe Biden's victory will mean big changes at government agencies, including a Justice Department that outgoing President Trump repeatedly attacked.
We have to not only rebuild the public's confidence in the Department of Justice as an institution, we're going to need to rebuild the sense of confidence and integrity on the inside.
Who might lead the Justice Department on the next Morning Edition from NPR News?
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Support is provided by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Tom Ezern is a scholar of history who shares stories from the past in his Plainsfolk essays. Today's piece concerns a form of fundraising entertainment that says something about the way things used to be. It's titled Shadow Socials.
At the Shadow Social, Saturday evening, a young fellow was bidding at his lady friend's shadow. So says the press report from Botno in December 1912. Three guys chipped in and bid over him, giving the shadow to another friend. This was just the sort of mischievous drama everyone hoped for at a shadow social. Probably the auctioneer for the evening, O.H. Samuelson, was in on the caper, or at least he encouraged it. The competitive bidding contributed to the strong proceeds from the social, $18.80, which pleased its host, Miss Alma Nelson of the North Star School. And the boys had a good laugh before supper and an evening filled with games and music. A specific variation on the more general institution of the basket social, or box social, the shadow social was a common fixture on the social calendars of prairie churches and schools in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. As with all box socials, ladies were expected to pack a supper for two, and gentlemen were expected to bid for the boxes and for the privilege of dining with the preparers. The special wrinkle of the box social was that during the auction, the ladies were sequestered in a side room, perhaps a cloakroom. A sheet was hung over the doorway, and each lady in turn took position behind it, concealed, except that a lamp or lantern behind her projected her silhouette onto the sheet for viewing by the bidders. Imagine the possibilities, the hilarities, and the opportunities for intrigue. Earlier the same year, 1912, the Williston Graphic explained how the process would work with the shadow social to be given by the YPS, the Young People's Society, on February 14th in the United Lutheran basement. The ladies are asked to bring a shoebox filled with lunch for two, and the shadow of the ladies will be sold to the highest bidder. The shadow may in each case serve as a beautiful valentine to the lucky bidder. Now, forgive me for how my mind works, but it should be obvious that the female form, projected in silhouette, was fundamental to the appeal of the shadow social. Which is why it surprises me that most of the early shadow socials in Dakota Territory took place in churches. The first one for which I have record took place in March 1886 at a Baptist church in Jamestown, with the press reporting. Several ladies who sat behind the screen were subjects of animated bidding. One lady sold for $10 and another for $5 in what was pronounced one of the most successful church entertainments given this winter. I read of a similar affair in Cooperstown in 1897. Under P.A. Melgard's able auctioneering, the shadows sold out at a good figure. Are we to believe that the term figure was deployed by the editor here with no sense of humor? Indeed, all the 19th century shadow socials I have identified were church affairs. In the 20th century, they more commonly took place in other public buildings, particularly schools, with the school teacher hosting. Reports of such affairs continue common into the early 1920s. In 1922, the Literary Society of one Emmons County School spiced up its monthly meeting by inserting a shadow social before the cultural program. "Come and buy your best girl's shadow," the invitation read. Late the same year, another school in the same county organized a Thanksgiving shadow social. "Ladies, bring lunch for two and sell your shadows." The custom dwindled during the 1920s, however, and once again, forgive me for speculating as to why. Is it only a coincidence that during the 1920s, when ladies' fashion emphasized slender bodies defined by straight lines, that interest in shadows of the female form faded? You can tell me if I have this figured wrong.
That's Tom Ezern. Coming up on Main Street, Augustana University's Patrick Hicks joins us to talk about his new historical novel, In the Shadow of Dora. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The chairman of the Red Lake Nation says the state of Minnesota is sending help to a nursing home on the reservation hit hard by COVID-19. Daryl Seeke says despite aggressive steps to control the virus on the reservation, cases have been increasing in recent weeks. That nursing home has been especially hard hit.
Well, see, what happened is they opened it up for visiting for a week. The residents start getting COVID. And then all of a sudden our nurses were getting it. The director of nursing was one, and even a director of a nursing home got COVID.
Seeke says it's been virtually impossible to hire staff because so many other nursing homes are dealing with shortages. He says he's grateful to Minnesota Governor Tim Walz for sending members of the Minnesota National Guard medical staff to help. North Dakota's Human Service Department says its 8 regional human service centers and 4 satellite clinics are open to provide on-site and community-based behavioral health services during a time of stress brought on by the COVID-19 pandemic. Dan Kramer is the director of the South Central Human Service Center in Jamestown. He says when the pandemic first started, a lot of services were switched to telehealth. But he says as things went on, they realized some people were really struggling, and those with the greatest amount of illness were struggling the most.
And maybe that sounds really, really obvious, but I think it was marked to see it, that the rates of homelessness among those with severe mental illness were going up, and the rates of hospitalization for that group that had the greatest illness were going up much more so than for anybody else.
So Kramer says the staff realized that telehealth was not sufficient for people in that group. He says they worked hard to be out in the community and seeing patients in person.
More often than not, the in-person contact for the individuals we serve really is required to be the most helpful. And so we've really ramped that up over the last probably 3 to 4 months of making sure that it's not just telehealth for those folks, but that we're both having people come here into the office, but many of the folks that we see, it makes more sense and it works better if we go out to their homes or if we go out to see them in the community.
And North Dakota's oil production rose above 1.2 million barrels in September. However,
so this may be about as good as it gets for a while.
North Dakota Mineral Resources Director Lynn Helms.
Completions are not keeping pace with the natural decline, and the return to production business has just about played itself out.
Helms says that's why $16 million in CARES Act money is being put toward fracking of so-called DUC wells, or drilled but uncompleted. On a brighter note from his monthly director's cut briefing, Helms says natural gas flaring is down. He says 93% of the gas was captured, even though gas production was up 7% from August.
The infrastructure got built, the infrastructure's there, and it looks like infrastructure's being built that's going to allow us to stay there.
Helms says a new gas plant is under construction and new gas gathering lines are being put in. State Pipeline Authority Director Justin Kringstead says there are other pending projects as well. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Hi, I'm Dave Thompson. Join me Thursday for Morning Edition on Prairie Public. NPR will bring you news from the nation and the world, and I'll have the latest stories from North Dakota and the Prairie region, along with the day's weather. Listen beginning at 4 a.m. Central on member-supported Prairie Public, telling North Dakota and the region's stories.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by a familiar voice to the listeners to Main Street, because Patrick Hicks is the host of Poetry from Studio 47, which is created at Augustana University in Sioux Falls, where he is writer in residence. Patrick, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, it's a real pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on.
And you're here to talk about your brand new novel, In the Shadow of Dora, a novel of the Holocaust and the Apollo program. This was an intriguing read, I have to tell you. This is a period of history that I'm interested in. I think lots of people are. But you knit together a terror weapon of World War II with one of the greatest occurrences in the 20th century, landing on the moon. Why did you write the book?
Well, after I finished my first novel, The Commandant of Lubezeck, which was a Holocaust novel, I just really needed to turn towards some light and towards some goodness. And the landing on the moon is just such a monumental feat of scientific ingenuity and human bravery that I was just drawn to it because I've always been fascinated by space. You know, I grew up in the 70s and, you know, Apollo, Skylab, I was just really fascinated by all of that. And as I started to do research, I guess the tug of the Holocaust still hadn't left me. And I realized quickly that embedded in the guts of that mighty Saturn V rocket that was created to get the Apollo missions up high enough so that we could launch them ultimately to the moon is a much smaller version of the very first rocket, the V2 rocket, which was built by the Nazis. And once I made that connection, I just wondered, well, what would it be like if someone experienced both of those, if the V2 was built by slave labor in a secret underground concentration camp? You know, what happened if I could have a character that experienced that and then also was a part of the incredible journey to the moon in the 1960s and early 70s?
Wernher von Braun was the Nazi rocket scientist who developed the V2 terror weapon and who was instrumental in building that Saturn V rocket that took us to the moon. Were there, in your research, did you turn up people who had actually been in that slave labor camp that you referred to, Dora Mittelbau, who ended up in the U.S. and perhaps in the space program?
Not that I'm aware of, not from someone who was a slave in Dora Mittelbau, this concentration camp, but certainly a surprising array of the Nazi scientists that were directly involved in Dora Mittelbau. Werner von Braun is just one of them. They ultimately did come over through something called Operation Paperclip, which was a secret government program in 1945, 1946 that brought some 800 Nazi scientists to the United States, and they escaped any sort of criminal justice. And it was a Faustian bargain that the United States has made. Essentially, we said, if you build us high-performance aircraft, if you build us the best rockets the world has ever seen, if you build us, you know, better poisons and these kinds of things, we will allow you to do that and be citizens of the country, and we won't prosecute you for your crimes against humanity. And von Braun is—he's a very, very complicated figure in the 20th century because he's very—he was a Nazi. He was in the SS, and he was very—he had apparently no problem using slave labor and seeing the deaths that happened in Dora Mittelbau to create his V2 rocket. But yet, it is undeniable that the man was a genius, and without his vision for the Saturn V. It's very doubtful, to me anyway, that we would have gotten to the moon by 1969. You know, maybe it would have happened in the 80s or 90s of the 20th century.
What was Dora Mittelbau?
I really appreciate this question because it is a concentration camp, but it's a concentration camp unlike really any other in the Nazi system at the time. The V-2 was developed and built at a place called Peenemünde, which is on the coast of northern Germany, and the Nazis would fire these V-2s for testing at Peenemünde. And ultimately, it was the Nazis that put something into space first. It wasn't the Soviets, it wasn't the Americans. The Nazis put the V-2, you know, it came back down, but it crossed the threshold of space. And Peenemünde was bombed very, very badly by the Americans and the British once the Allies realized what was being built there. So to answer your question, it was decided that a concentration camp would be built into the guts of a mountain so that the war and the bombs couldn't fall upon this secret facility. So there were these huge cavernous caves that were carved out of the Harz Mountains right in the center of Germany. And it was here in this camp called Dora Mittelbau that the V-2 was built in the same way that Henry Ford built his cars. And they started to roll out at a fast clip. But Dora Mittelbau was a place of ferocious cruelty. And it's been kind of girded in secret because it began as a secret camp. It was liberated by the Americans, and we really didn't want people to know much about the rocket technology was there. And then the Iron Curtain came down, and Dora Mittelbau was in the East German side. So it's a camp that doesn't resonate, I think, with Americans as much as, say, Dachau or Auschwitz might.
Your principal character is named Eli Hessel. He's a Jewish mathematician, prisoner laborer, and Apollo scientist. He's at the center of your story. How did you research the character and the circumstances he found himself in?
I did a lot of typical research, I suppose, you know, going to the library and things like that. And I read as many primary accounts and memoirs of actual prisoners that went through Dora Mittelbau. And I lifted some of those stories and grafted them onto what Eli experiences. But because Eli does survive, and then he ultimately he moves to the United States, and ultimately he's hired by NASA to work on the Saturn V rockets. That's when I was able to start to bring my secondary research of surviving the Holocaust and the psychological weight of carrying the Holocaust. So that was one aspect of the research that I put into this book. But the other aspects was physical travel. So I went to Dora Mittelbau on two separate research trips. It's near the town of Nordhausen. I did a lot of research in Berlin as well. And I went to the Kennedy Space Center in Florida, the Johnson Space Center in Houston, and the Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama. And that's where Wernher von Braun lived and worked and ultimately developed the Saturn V rocket. So in total, it took me about 4 years to write In the Shadow of Dora, but I'm really so very grateful that the early reviews, they've all noticed the research that's gone into it, and somehow I've managed to make the year 1944 and the year 1969 sort of rise up and feel as if they're present.
1944 is near the end of World War II, and that's what struck me about this, the timing of this, this V-2, which is a vengeance weapon, that's really what it was known as, was fired up in the sky and came crashing down at faster than the speed of sound, so there was no warning of its explosion. But it was a terror weapon. It had minimal strategic value.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And, you know, I lived in England for quite a while, and my wife is British. She lives, you know, she immigrated to South Dakota when we moved here about 20 years ago. So my in-laws, I have several in-laws that, you know, experienced the Blitz and experienced the V-1 and the V-2 rocket attacks on London. And you're absolutely right. It was a weapon of terror, because it was traveling at five times the speed of sound when it entered British airspace. There was no way that you could know that it was going to hit. And some people refer to it as the second Blitz, but it was designed to unhinge the people of London, because you never knew when this thing would fall. Nighttime, during the day, while you're out walking, it could arrive at any time. And there was genuine fear that, I mean, there was explosives at the tip of the V-2 rocket, but there was genuine fear that from the Londoners that perhaps Hitler would put anthrax in the V-2. Now, that never happened, but it very easily could have.
Well, you mentioned Peenemunde, which was probably the most famous launch site for V-2s, but they were set up to be launched virtually anywhere that you could get a truck eventually. And Nordhausen is very close to this development, this slave labor camp, Dora Mittelbau. What did they know in Nordhausen, and when did they know it?
That's a rich question, and I really appreciate that, because it gets to not just what happened at Nordhausen, but we could equally ask the same questions of Dachau, Bergen-Belsen, Buchenwald, Auschwitz. So the neighbors around these camps, you know, what did they know? What didn't they know? And after researching the Holocaust for so many decades, I believe that the people around these places did know what was happening. And in the case of Dora Mittelbau, they might not have realized exactly what was being built, but they could see the rockets coming out on the rail cars to be sent off to these individual sort of launching sites, these mobile launching sites. And if you were in Nordhausen, you would be able to see the crematoria stack, and you'd see the smoke rising up. So, and on top of that, the prisoners were often in town, you know, doing slave labor. So the people around there would have known, but I think it became an act of convenience after the war to claim ignorance. Because if you claim ignorance, then you don't have to claim any sort of responsibility.
Well, there was a two-day bombing raid in April of 1945, which you cover in the book in some detail, that obliterated most of the town. So, in a sense, their knowledge or lack of knowledge was fatal.
Yeah. Yeah, it was the Americans and the British. Nordhausen was devastated. I mean, huge chunks of it disappeared. The city of Nordhausen had existed for well over 1,000 years, had gorgeous architecture, really old churches, and it was all flattened because it was also a military target. And when I was in Nordhausen and walking around, I was aware of how new the buildings looked. And because it was in the East German sector, it also had a different style of architecture. You know, the people of Nordhausen were very friendly to me, but I didn't personally find it a very attractive city to be in, with the exception of the rebuilt city center. So the scars of World War II are all across Germany today, but I really noticed it very clearly when I was at Nordhausen itself.
Patrick Hicks is the author of In the Shadow of Dora, a novel of the Holocaust and the Apollo program. He's also a writer in residence at Augustana University in Sioux Falls. You know, I asked the question, what did the people of Nordhausen know and when did they know it? What about the Allies?
You know, there was, you mentioned Auschwitz, Bergen-Belsen, Buchenwald, Majdanek, but Dora Mittelbau. These were places that were well-known, festering, terrible places well before the end of the war.
Yeah. And this is, it's kind of hard to think about, but the Allies did know about Auschwitz. They knew what was happening at Auschwitz, but the decision was made that the quickest way to stop these types of camps was to end the war. So, I mean, that's a moral question, which I think is hard to sort of wrestle with, but that's the brass. That's Eisenhower and people that are, you know, very much in charge of the conquering of Nazi Germany. But if we were to look more at like the grunt soldiers on the ground, that was a deep shock to them, finding these camps and finding out what was happening in these camps. And I know, as I've talked to a couple of veterans that liberated these camps, it's never really left them, you know, what they experienced going into, you know, they open the gates of these places and finding what they find.
Wernher von Braun was in your book. He comes across as a bit of an opportunist. He probably really was. The money and the research capability under the Nazis was pretty much wide open, and it would have been shut completely if he hadn't become a member of the SS, but he was a member of the SS. Satirist Mort Sahle, I came across this just today, once mocked von Braun by saying, "I aim at the stars, but sometimes I hit London."
Yes.
So he certainly knew what he was doing. And then he becomes this larger-than-life science figure in American culture in the 1960s, and before that, but in the 1960s in particular. Walt Disney makes a special about him.
Yes. And I did research on that. And I'm sure that some of your listeners maybe have very clear memories of watching Man in Space, which did feature von Braun with animation by Disney. And it's really hard to sort of square the jovial sort of space pioneer with the man who was also a war criminal. But very clearly, when he came to the United States, I mean, he was a very gregarious and charismatic individual to begin with. But when we started to really think very seriously about going into space, he was almost a purpose-built spokesman because he had so much energy and that thousand-watt smile of his. So he's such an interesting character in the 20th century. If you've watched Dr. Strangelove, you know, some of the characters that are in that particular movie are sort of loosely based on von Braun.
Yes. Yes. Peter Sellers.
Yeah, that's right.
Played Dr. Strangelove, yes. When I was a kid, I knew all about Wernher von Braun. I was captivated by the space program. I read science fiction work and stories by Willy Ley, who was a contemporary of Wernher von Braun's. I think they were both raised Lutheran in Germany. Ley fled the country before the Nazis got submerged in war. I just find their interconnection intriguing myself because they were two similar people with similar passions. They both have craters on the moon named after them, but one stayed, one fled. And that was sort of the NASA story when you got to, there was this mix of German Nazi scientists who made it all possible.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, that's one of the things that I explore in my latest novel, In the Shadow of Dora, is because they are given all of these, the rewards of being a part of NASA, and they're just showered with, you know, glory and all of these kinds of things for helping get us to the moon. But the flip side of that, which I wanted to investigate in my novel, is, well, what happens to the men? And they were, almost all of them were men in Dora Mittelbau. I just couldn't stop thinking about the fact that, okay, so if you survived Dora Mittelbau, the men who were very literally your slave drivers and your tormentors are now on television launching America literally on the greatest adventure humanity has yet undertaken. And I just wondered what kind of psychological burden that must have been to have the weight of the Holocaust and yet to have the aspirational pull to the moon. And one of the things that I I explore in the novel is this idea that, you know, when we talk about what a hoax is in the 20th century, some people call the Holocaust a hoax, which I find morally repulsive, but other people refer to the Apollo landings as a hoax. And I don't think that that is entirely accidental, because one represents the worst of what we are capable of doing to each other, and the other represents the best of what we are capable of doing when we work with each other. And they represent the poles of what it means to be a human being. And ultimately, that's what I was really most drawn to when it came to writing this new novel.
Well, there's a bit of irony to this V2 weapon, that it probably killed twice as many people who built the device than it landed among. It was deadly, obviously, to the people who were the slave laborers at Dora Mittelbau. And it just defies credulity that something like this was done, considering how the Nazi hierarchy would have known this would be viewed in just months.
Yes, yeah, you're absolutely right. If you entered Dora Mittelbau, there was a 30% chance you wouldn't be leaving it. It was a very lethal place. And there were no gas chambers at Dora Mittelbau, but there didn't need to be, because the unofficial camp slogan was Vernichtung durch Arbeit, which is German for execution through work, or death through work. So they were worked to death. They were starved to death. They were beaten. And it's a strange thing to think about, that the highest of high technology for the day in 1944 was being built in such abject misery. It defies our imagination in many ways.
What did you learn that most surprised you as you were writing and researching this book?
I was surprised, I guess, by how many Nazi scientists came to the United States, because I'd known about Wernher von Braun and Arthur Rudolph and Kurt Debus and Walter Dornberger. Those were sort of the big names that orbited around the V2 project. But I was really surprised, maybe even shocked, to find out just how many Nazi scientists came to the U.S. and how deeply influential they were to the military and the industrial military complex that arose from that. That was a surprise to me.
Well, I have to say, it would make an intriguing movie. It's written in a very compelling fashion. It's hard to put down. I couldn't put it down, so I would recommend it. In the Shadow of Dora is the name of the book. Patrick, are you working on anything new now?
I am, yes. I'm trying to juggle being a good professor during a pandemic, of course, but I know what the next book is going to be about, and it will be a revisiting to the Holocaust, but I don't want to give too much away, but I want to examine gender and violence, especially female Nazis and violence, and sort of see where that intersection takes place. So I have the story in my head, but I'm keeping it really close to my chest.
Okay. Are you looking at another four-year project here, or is this further along?
I hope not. I've already done the research, so I'm hoping I can pound out the first draft sometime before fall of 2021.
Patrick Hicks is the author of In the Shadow of Dora, a novel of the Holocaust and the Apollo program. It's out by the Stephen F. Austin University Press. He's also the author of The Commandant of Lubezek, and a writer of poetry collections, and you hear him on Main Street as the host of Poetry from Studio 47. Patrick, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Decoded 8 Book is next.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
What's for dinner tonight in Bulgaria?
Our main course, of course, a lot of grilled and barbecued meats. We have kebabche or kofte.
In the southwest of France, they like duck.
In Gascony, duck fat is what you cook with, and it lends a depth of flavor to almost everything.
And learn how olive oil is the heart of a Mediterranean diet.
The Italians say their olives are better.
On the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for November 18th, celebrating 100 years since the passage of the 19th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote. This series is written and voiced by Sarah Walker.
On November 2, 1920, eligible men and women around the country were able to vote equally in the election for the first time. According to the Census Bureau, approximately 26 million women were now able to vote. However, there were still an estimated 1.5 million women considered ineligible. Ineligibility highlighted inequalities in the country. Native American and Asian women were not allowed to vote. Other women of color were also limited, depending on where they lived and what rules were in place. Of course, women who were not citizens were not able to vote, unless they were married to an American. However, American women were also unable to vote if they were married to men who were not U.S. citizens. In the mix as well were those women, quote, deprived of the ballot under state statutes in harmony with constitutional provisions. Despite these imbalances, the first presidential election after the suffrage amendment passed was of great interest. Now that they had it, would women take advantage of the vote? On election day, North Dakota was enjoying excellent weather, and many communities reported a good turnout of female voters. In Bismarck, women gathered outside polls before they opened. It was reported that 25 St. Alexius sisters and 12 from St. Mary's marched in a body to the polls, and three nuns were the first to vote in one location. By late morning in Minot, slightly more women than men had voted. Jamestown showed fairly even numbers, with many women campaigning and voting for the anti-Lee candidate for governor, quote, disproving the assertion made by many that the women would vote as did their sons, brothers, and husbands, end quote. According to the Bobel's Tribune, Burke County women frequently showed up before the male voters, adding that the women have proven themselves to be intelligent voters. No mistake has been made in giving them the privilege of voting. In Mandan, however, it was reported that women turned out in surprisingly small numbers, especially in the German-Russian precincts. By this date, as election statistics and results were being unraveled, it was reported that while more male than female voters turned out in North Dakota, the overwhelming majority of both voted in support of an amendment adding women's suffrage to the state constitution. This is Sarah Walker.
This series is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota and the North Dakota Women's Suffrage Centennial Commission, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Thank you for joining us today for our Main Street Show, broadcast or online, however you listened. After the show, you can find any Main Street program at prairiepublic.org. Thursday on our show, a new book draws parallels between our time and the 18th century during a time of remarkable change. Rethinking the Enlightenment, Faith in the Age of Reason is the work of University of Mary history professor Joseph Stewart. We'll talk with Dr. Matt Eaton with Family Healthcare in Fargo about dental care during the pandemic. And Sue Balcom will join us for Main Street Eats to talk about honey. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Thursday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.